As temperatures reach 40 below, even the adults' only chance of survival is to huddle together. They start to waddle with a single purpose. All converge on the same central point until a huddle begins to form. Each penguin must find a place to tuck in. But by speeding up the action, it's clear that something more organized is going on. Soon, the huddle numbers thousands, and still more keep coming. While those on the outside take the brunt of the storm, those on the inside take tiny steps that move the huddle in waves. The densely packed penguins continue to shift and rotate from the center. By keeping constantly on the move, no penguin is left permanently out in the cold.
I wanted to share that quickly before I started, because it's really interesting, my sermon is called Penguins and Porcupines. And we're going to make a comparison between what you saw there. I'm going to come back to that and talk about it a little bit more. But good morning, everybody. How's it working, Bunky? Good, good. So before I come back to the penguins, three engineers and three accountants were traveling by train to conference. At the station, the three accountants each bought tickets and watched the three engineers buy only one ticket. How are three people going to travel on only one ticket? The accountants were asking. Watch and you'll see, said the engineers. They all boarded the train, and the accountants took their respective seats, but the three engineers all crammed into a restroom and closed the door behind them. Shortly after the train departed, the conductor came around asking to collect the tickets. Tickets, please, he'd say. He came up to the bathroom. The door opened just a crack, and a single arm emerged with ticket in hand. And the conductor took it and moved on. The accountant saw that this, they saw this and agreed. It was quite a clever idea, also immoral. So after the conference, the accountants decide to copy the engineers on the return trip to save money also, because accountants are so clever with money. When they got to the station, though, they bought their single ticket, and they had their plan, and they noticed, to their astonishment, that the engineers didn't buy any ticket at all this time. And they asked the engineers, again, how are you going to ride without a ticket? And the engineers replied, watch and you'll see, a second time. When they boarded the train, the three accountants crammed into a restroom, and the three engineers crammed into another restroom nearby. The train departed. Shortly afterward, one of the engineers left his restroom, walked over to the restroom where the accountants were hiding, knocked on the door and said, tickets please. So that's just a short, funny story about some friends and how they get along together. The video that we saw is about a group of friends that have to get along together to survive. And with penguins, it's pretty amazing what they do and how they all can work together. And what I noticed about it is that that works pretty good for penguins because they all look the same. They all act the same. They're not really, they're so alike each other, you wouldn't really ever be able to tell any of them apart from one another. And so that's kind of convenient if you're trying to get along with people, if you're a lot like them. But what happens if you're like a porcupine? If porcupines were to try this, and they need to do this, they need the warmth just as much as penguins need the warmth. But if a number of porcupines huddle together for warmth on a cold winter day, what happens is there's always the possibility that they could poke each other with their quills. And that hurts. That doesn't feel good. That doesn't make you worry about being warm anymore. It makes you focus on the pain. You focus, and what happens is you become obliged to disperse. You become distant because you've been pricked by that quill. And so I'm going to get away from this. I don't care about the warmth anymore. But the cold, once you realize it, once that porcupine leaves, eventually what happens is it starts to get cold again. And so it's this volley back and forth of, it's too cold, I'm going to die. I need warmth. I need companionship. If I get too close to this group of porcupines, I'm going to get stabbed again. Eventually, after the porcupines huddle and disperse, and they huddle and disperse, they discover that they're best off by remaining at a little distance from one another. Kind of that happy place, if you will. They can stand just close enough to where they can get enough warmth to survive, but not close enough to where they're always poking each other all the time. The moderate distance, which they at last discover to be only tolerable, is the code of politeness and the fine manners, basically, that those who transgress should be looking at when somebody says, keep your distance. This arrangement and the mutual need of warmth is only very moderately satisfied, but then people do get pricked. And a man who's not humble and has that pride in himself prefers to remain outside, where he will neither prick other people nor get pricked himself. And much like in the scripture reading that Johnny read, it talks about that. It talks about focusing on the stripes rather than being gentle unto all men, being apt to teach, being patient. Verse 25 says, in meekness instructing those that oppose themselves, if God will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth, that they may recover themselves of the snare of the devil who are taken captive by him and his will. One of my favorite verses that I started to learn on Scripture Typer is Romans chapter 1. And I ended up learning verses 21 through 23. And I always kind of knew this verse. I always had it memorized, but only a part of it. I only had verse 23 memorized. And it says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. But if you can turn there, we'll read the whole thing. It's Romans 1, 21 through 23. And this always made me think of the pride of the world. It made me think of See, I've never been a smart person. I've never, done well in school. I don't have a college degree. So I look at these people that do, and these scientists and these evolutionists, and these facts and dates and knowledge coming off of them all the time. Like, I could never be the person to go on Jeopardy. I don't know that much about Shakespeare. You know, they always have those categories where it's just like these facts that you need to know. I've never been that person. But what I see in those people is that it comes out in this verse. I just think of this verse every time. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And I've met people, I work with people this way, that they're incredibly smart. But when it comes to basic knowledge of certain things, common sense stuff, they don't have it. It's like they do weird things. They do dumb things. I'm like, you're so smart, how can you... You have all these advantages in life. You're way smarter than me. You have a better memory than me. You can't... I have to struggle through every single step to get where you are so easily. But then you make these simple mistakes. God knows this. He knows that when they're focused on their own wisdom and their own pride, and they're poking each other with their quills, that they're only made out to be fools. The whole thing, which I ended up wanting to memorize, it says, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. See, they focused on their own knowledge. They focused on their own ideas. And they didn't recognize God. Neither were they thankful to God. But they became vain in their imaginations. Their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And you know what they did? They changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man. They made idols. They made them out of birds. They made them out of beasts, creeping things, and they denied God of his glory. Have you ever been hurt by someone and wanted to hurt them back? I told a story in my class. I've been thinking, this kept popping up in my head this week. But I remember when I was 10 years old, and I've never been into a fight. I've never been into a fight. That's saying something, probably, for most people. That's an accomplishment at this age and stage in my life. I don't think I've ever been into a fight. Hopefully I'm not forgetting something. But I almost did get into a fight one time. Now, my brothers, that's a good point, but my brothers were like, all way older than me, so there was not much of a fight. It was just, I got slapped around a few times, but but never really been into a real fight where I was trying to cause harm to someone. But I went to a wedding, And I barely remember this, when I was like 10 years old, and I was all dressed up in these like horrible cowboy clothes and nice shirt and stuff. And I didn't like being there and didn't want to be at the wedding, but there was some other kids there, and they seemed pretty cool. And I wanted to see if they wanted to play football or something. How inappropriate does this sound? But anyway, so we're having cake, and this never happened. Like, we never got to play football or anything, but we're just having cake, and I don't know any of these kids, and I'm just trying to be friendly and get to know them, trying to do the penguin march here. And I'm waiting for everybody to finish their cake. And before any of that could happen, this huge, like, glob of frosting and cake comes and splats onto my chest, like right in the middle of my chest, right on my shirt. And I look down, and I'm like, that did not just happen. I'm like 10 years old. And I look up, and there's this kid with, like, this kid was, I still have a vision. I don't know, he had these, like, dark green eyes, and it just made me hate him even more, just the way that he looked. And he had a spoon, and I could tell it was him. I could tell what he was doing, and he had just, like, for no reason, I didn't even know this kid, and I didn't know him at all, and he decided that he knew me well enough to be able to throw cake on me without anything happening. And I was furious. I remember just being, and everything was going through my mind. I'm like, I'm going to get this kid. I'm gonna just wait until he's not looking. I'm going to go around. All these things were going through my mind. And apparently, it was kind of obvious. Because before I could even act, before I could even, do something about it, I guess. Like, he never really apologized to me. And I was still kind of like mad at him. But what he did do was he kind of called me out of what I was feeling. Like, he read what was going on in my mind. And that kind of threw me off. He was like, I know that look. I know what you're planning on doing. And I was like, what? How do you know that? What are you talking about? And that was enough for me to catch myself, to stop my anger that I was feeling, and just realize I started to process it in my mind. Well, whatever. I don't even like this shirt anyway. I'll just clean it off. These kids are jerks. It's not worth getting into. It's not worth doing something stupid. You know, it's not worth losing my common sense. It's not worth professing myself to be wiser than God in every situation. And so I didn't do anything to that kid. I gave him mercy. And I don't know what he thought of it after that, but maybe he felt a little remorse for what he did. But it's that's an example of how even the strongest, even the most patient, will want to retaliate if they get pricked with those quills. I would imagine that Esau was one of those people. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Jacob and Esau today. But I want to share one more thing real quick.
I'm Kathy Peterson.
That kind of relates to this. Bear with me.
Take those guard hairs, and then you should thrust it.
This is kind of an educational thing. If you ever get an animal that's that finds a porcupine, gets too close to him.
Tail off into my hand. Are you ready?
I love how I get myself into these things. One, two. Yep, there we go. That's a handful of quills.
Now, the ones on the top of my hand really aren't that bad,
It's those ones right there. Can you see how deep those are into my finger? It hurts to move my finger right now. I mean, I think they touch bone. It hurts a lot. I think most of them are going to be pretty easy to get out. Those two are going to be extremely painful. Well, I got a handful of quills here for my little friend the porcupine right there. I'm going to show you guys how to get these out of either your hand or your dog. I have a feeling this is going to be pretty painful. All right, come on, let's go. The one in my finger hurts so bad right now. Now, it's most likely that your dog is going to get quilled by a porcupine. And, you know, you might think, oh, I'm just going to pull that quill straight out. It's not going to work. These have microscopic barbs on the end. And one of the cool techniques of the porcupine quill is that once it's in there, it works deeper and deeper and deeper. So you want to get these out as quick as you possibly can. And I never recommend that you go out and get yourself quilled by a porcupine. And the reason that I did this today was to show you how to remove quills from your hand. And the reason that I snipped off the tops of all the quills is that it actually releases pressure inside of the quill, relaxes the barbs, and now they should release out of my hand a bit easier. And what I want to do is gently grab the quills, twist them, and pull straight up. I'm going to remove the ones that aren't as deep first. I want to get all those barbs and those little points out of there because they can cause an infection, and that's the last thing that I want to happen. If you were a mountain lion, bear, or coyote, you got a face full of these quills. I mean, it's debilitating. I barely move my hand, and these animals wouldn't be able to then go out and continue hunting. And I can see why eventually this could cause a large predator like that to die. Ooh, my hand hurts. Okay, these are the last three. It's not like a Band-Aid. And you don't just pull it off. You just pull these out, it's going to rip all the skin out with it because of those tiny little microscopic barbs. Okay, I'm going to twist and pull straight up. That's the goal.
I'll spare you guys. that can get a little gruesome. But you get the idea. He purposely put his hand where, and this is the amazing thing, like, porcupines were so notorious for the way that they're able to thrust their quills into people that there used to be a myth that they would actually be able to do, like, you couldn't get too close to a porcupine because they'll shoot them at you. They were able to shoot these quills at you because of the force. You see how deep that went into his hand just from him barely putting his hand next to the porcupine, and all he had to do was a tiny thrust, and those wedged all the way down to the bone. And they used to think they were so dangerous that they could shoot them. But that's not true. They can't really shoot them at them, but if you get close to them, that's what happens. And he was able to get those out by using the pliers and rotating it as he's not just pulling it straight out, but rotating it along. And he ended up bleeding in that video because it was so bad. But that's how dangerous that we can be sometimes. The barbs that we have. Because we're not like penguins. We're more like porcupines. We have that ability to jab each other, to hurt each other. And so, for us, reconciliation is a lot harder. Because it's not like those quills ever go away. Sure, yeah, you can try to go get close to somebody again. But you still have those quills, and they still know that you have those quills. So there's got to be that place that you find where you can trust each other. Where you're not going to get too close to each other again. And if you can turn with me to Genesis 27... we're going to go through a story, Jacob and Esau, where there was a trust broken. There was something between these two brothers that made them not get along, that made one of them seek revenge against the other. It reads like a juicy novel. And the brothers, they were born to Isaac. If you remember the story. And Isaac was the son of Abraham. And when they were born, Jacob, they were born together, they were twins. Jacob was born second, so he didn't get the blessing, he didn't get the birthright, that always went to the firstborn. And Jacob, he was known, his nickname, he was also known as a heel catcher. Because when they were born, Esau came out first, and Jacob, as a little tiny baby, was gripping on to Esau's heel as he was born. He wouldn't let him out of the womb. Like, he didn't want to be second. And so he was always known as heel grabber, heel catcher, ever since then. And they were so different. Esau was like really hairy and an outdoorsman, and Jacob was kind of close to his mother and liked to do things. And he was real intellectual, and he knew how to get over on people. He knew how to put himself in a better position at the expense of other people, taking advantage of them, outsmarting them. And so this happens. And I'm just summarizing this to save time to get to the next chapter. But Jacob tricked Esau out of his birthright. And then with the help of the scheming of his mother, Rebekah, he did it again. But this time it was with his blessing. So Esau at this point has no reason to like Jacob, to trust Jacob. Jacob has not only taken one thing from Esau, but two things. And as the story unfolds, after this happened, Esau, just like getting splattered with cake on your chest or whatever it is that someone can do to you that you don't like, to become your enemy. And yes, we have enemies. We have people that rise up against us. We have people that disagree with us. The Bible's definition of an enemy can be anyone. It's somebody that disagrees with you. And we don't like to think of each other as being enemies. But sometimes we are each other's enemies because we're not on the same path. We're not going the same direction sometimes. We have disagreements. And this was a disagreement that Esau did not want to forget. He was so infuriated over it that his plan was to kill his brother. At the first opportunity that I get, I'm going to kill my brother because of what he did to me. And Jacob was afraid. And Rebekah was afraid. And they had to come up with this plan to swell to distill the anger of Esau. And they said, you know what? Go live with your uncle. Go far away from here. That way, he doesn't try to kill you. And so he did. And a lot happens. 14 years pass. Jacob starts a family. Esau has his own family. All this time passes, and there's still this conflict between Jacob and Esau. There's still this harboring of resentment and anger, forgiveness and guilt. All these emotions going through everything that happened. Just like when a porcupine gets poked and wants to go out away from the group. they were distant from each other. So picking up in the story in chapter 32, Jacob has two wives. He has 10 or 11, probably 11, 10 kids, 11 kids at this point. 12 if you count Dinah. And he starts to revert back to his old self. How can I get out of this? How can I take my situation and make it better for me? That was his focus. And I'm amazed at the lengths that he's willing to go to be able to get out of this situation because of his fear of his brother trying to kill him. And he's been living with this for 14 years, by the way. And he feels guilty about taking advantage of his brother. It says, Jacob went his way, starting with verse 1 in chapter 32. And the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, unto the land of Seir, the kingdom of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Thus shall ye speak unto my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob saith, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. And I have oxen and flocks and all this stuff. And I have sent it to you that I might find grace in your sight. So I prepared this gift for you, Esau, to pay you back so that you'll have mercy on me and you'll give me grace." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and we saw that he had 400 men with him." Esau has like an army marching towards Jacob. And it says, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two bands. Right? It's the old adage, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Jacob was doing that with his family. He was saying, well, I don't want my entire family to be wiped out. So I'm going to just separate it into two groups. That way, if one of them gets attacked, the other one can get away. And he was thinking about this in terms of his brother with his 400 men being willing to go to the lengths of killing him, like he said he was going to do 14 years ago, and not only doing that, but wiping out his entire family. That's how afraid he was of Esau at this point. Picking up on verse 9, it says, Jacob said, "O God, my father Abraham, and God of my father of Isaac, the Lord which saidest unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of at least all of the mercies and all of the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, for the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou saidest, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed of the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for a multitude." And he lodged there that same night and took that which came to his hand, a present for Esau his brother. And skipping down to verse 16, he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and said unto his servants, "Pass over before me, and put a space between each drove," drove and drove. So, this is really interesting, the idea that he comes up with. And this is really smart. Jacob was really smart. Because if he's afraid of Esau, he feels like he's being directed by God to go back into his land. He can't hide anymore. He can't run away. He can't stay with Laban. So he's being driven back to where his brother is. And he knows that God wants him to be there, so he's trying to follow God. But he has this problem. He has this thing from his past that he can't get rid of. He has these quills that are still poking him. And he has quills of his own that could poke Esau. And so this genius plan is he breaks up all of his assets, all of his wealth, everything that he's acquired in the past 14 years, and he breaks it up into waves. He calls it droves, right? It's like a wave of kindness and grace. Oh, here. And he sends these droves to Esau one at a time. And he places them in strategic locations so that Jacob will not have to see Esau right away. But he's looking at it from Esau's perspective. Well, if Jacob sees me, his rage is going to flare up again. But if he sees one of my droves and a servant there and saying that I'm humble and this is an offering to you and you can have all this, and this is from Jacob, then maybe it'll be easier for Esau to have compassion on him. And he doesn't do this just one time. Like I said, this was waves. He sent one wave after the next, at least four or five of these waves of tidings, of gifts and offerings to Esau. He's trying to appease him. And he's hoping that Esau will accept it. He will accept the gift and that he'll forgive me because of the gift. And because they're still brothers. So this was his plan. And in the middle of all of his plan, he gets separated from his family. He had distributed all of his wealth out to Esau. And then he was left alone. And when he was left alone, do you know what happened? Going to verse 24, he wrestled with a man until the breaking of the day. So it's almost like he went to sleep and some man comes and starts wrestling with him. And he had to be thinking about that quill in his side that Esau's trying to kill him. And then just out of the blue in this story, why wouldn't you think it was Esau? Why wouldn't you think that you were being attacked by Esau? That's your greatest fear right now. You're doing everything you could. And then you start wrestling with this stranger. But as they were wrestling, he decided that something was off. Something was different. He realized this wasn't Esau. He realized that he wasn't going to be able to prevail against this stranger. But he wasn't going to give up. And this stranger ended up disabling him because he wouldn't let him go. And he was asking for a blessing from this stranger. And he said unto him, "What is your name?" And he said, "My name is Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thy power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. And Jacob asked him and said, tell me, I pray thee, your name. And this stranger, in the next verse, it's revealed, he wouldn't tell him his name. He was kind of insulted that you even ask his name. Why do you ask my name? You know who I am. But he called the place Peniel, for he said he had seen God face to face and his life was preserved. See, this was part of what Jacob was going through right now. It was part of putting away his past, putting away this idea that he's going to be better than everybody else. He's going to be able to take advantage of people. He's going to live this kind of lifestyle where he gets glory from God at the expense of others. That's not the way it works. God doesn't expect you to get advancement at the expense of others. He expects us to be servants, to be humble. And after he had wrestled with God, he was willing to give up so much more. In chapter 33, they finally were going to meet. Jacob lifted up his eyes, and Esau came with his 400 men. And he's still a little worried. He's even putting his family as an order of priority in case Esau still tries to do something to him. And he put his family members that he most cared about in the back, and his other family members towards the front. Maybe the ones that were older that could run faster or something went wrong. And then he starts bowing down to Esau. He did it 7 times to show him that he meant well and that he was sorry. And that he needed forgiveness. And he understood how he had taken away the blessing from Esau. How he had taken his birthright. How it wasn't fair. How it was hurtful to Esau. And the next thing that happens, Esau runs to meet him. And embraces him, hugs him. And they cried together because at that point they had realized that whatever squabbles that they had between each other were pointless. And they realized that the 14 years that they hadn't seen each other were lost, and they couldn't get those back. Esau was reconciled to Jacob. And Jacob no longer had to live with this guilt. And God gave him a new name so that he could no longer be a heel catcher, but he could be the servant of God. Why are we afraid to get close? Romans 12:17 says, recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as is in you. Live peaceable with all men. Avenge not yourselves. Don't worry about if somebody has hurt you. Don't give place to your anger. Don't let it swell up in you and turn you into a person that you don't want to be. God says, vengeance is mine. And he will repay. He will take care of you. He will provide for you. If your enemy hungers, there's that word enemy again. Do we have any enemies? Each one of us has enemies. We don't want to admit it. There's people that, I'm not helping that person. They did this to me. They did this to me. I can't trust them. They're dangerous. If your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him drink. For in doing so, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Don't be overcome by the evil, but overcome evil with good. It takes some discernment, for sure, to be able to deal with people. Deal with other porcupines that have hurt you. It takes some discernment about how close to get. But we can never let the idea of overcoming evil with good leave our mind. We can never let our own wisdom overtake what we're able to do. Professing ourselves to be wise, we became fools. We cannot become fools because we think we know what's better than God. If we ask God what we should do, like Jacob was, he wasn't just doing all these things anymore. He was trying to follow the will of God the best way that he knew how. And the best way that he knew how was to try to offer these things to Esau so that he would to make it easier for him to forgive him. Understanding God's purpose is ultimately one of the hardest things for us to do. When you throw in the fact that he created evil and he allows that evil to attack us, it makes it even more confusing. But God is so amazing and Jesus is so great that he can take unappealing ingredients of our lives and make something that tastes good. It's like when you make a cake. You got the flour. You got sugar. You got like nutmeg. You got cinnamon. You got all these different things that you can put in a cake. You got a slab of butter. You know, put it like a cube of butter into your cake. Now, any one of those things. Do you ever see anybody like put a cube of butter on a plate, put it in the microwave for about 10 seconds, and take a spoon and just eat the butter? That's good. No, that's terrible, right? None of these ingredients by themselves are any good. We have all these things that happen in our lives that we can't understand. And we don't think that God should be allowing all this evil to happen to us. We don't think it's a good idea to just eat flour by itself. It's not a good thing. We don't see it as a good thing. But God, what he does is he mixes all these things together. He sees the flour And he sees what could be. He sees where you're going to be after you go through these problems. And what ultimately you're going to get when the cake comes out of the oven. It's going to be delicious. It's going to be magnificent. We're going to spend eternity with Jesus because he allowed us to make that choice. He gave us this free will. He's given us this opportunity. And so let's take that opportunity. Let's not focus on the quills and the idols, but try to take each ingredient that God gives us and use it to glorify God in grace and in mercy and forgiveness. And to reconcile. Because God knows where we need to be. And we have a Savior that we can trust in. God bless you.